Good morning. We're here now to consider the case of Marvin Robinson versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 041690. Who will speak for Mr. Robinson?
Robert Chisholm, could you come in here?
Mr. Chisholm. And who will speak for the Secretary?
Good morning, Your Honor. Leslie Rogel, and we use Gun Moriarty.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Chisholm.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Make it so.
I'd like to begin by answering the three questions first in the supplemental order in this case, and then spend a little bit of time at the end discussing the actual merits of the direct service connection. The first question that the court asked in the supplemental order was whether the court should apply an exhaustion requirement to a veteran. I think there's really three cases that address this issue. The first is Majeed, which was decided in February 2000 by the Federal Circuit. And in that case, the Federal Circuit decided that it did not want to create a bright line rule at that point to decide one way or the other whether a veteran's case should mandate exhaustion or not. What the court said in that case was that one needed to analyze the competing interests of the individual versus the institution. A couple months later, the Supreme Court decided the case of Sims v. Apple. In Sims, the Supreme Court examined both the statutory and regulatory requirements of Social Security and found that there was no regulatory statutory reason to require exhaustion. And then Sims went into a discussion of the nature of the proceedings. And because Social Security was a non-adversarial system, it found that wasn't appropriate in that setting to impose an issue of exhaustion requirement. In the VA context, there is no specific statute of regulation that requires issue exhaustion. 7105C3, the statute, doesn't require appellant to set forth specific allegations of error, although it says it should, that one should. And 38 CFR 20.202 says the appellant should set out arguments, but then explains that the board will liberally construe them. The final case to this puzzle, I think, is the Forshee case. And in Forshee, the Federal Circuit applied the exhaustion requirement to an issue that wasn't raised before this court and could be raised in the Federal Circuit for the first time. And in Forshee, it's court-on-court review as opposed to court-on-agency review. I think in examining the statutes and the regulations, first 38 U.S.C. 7104A, and then 38 CFR 3.103, it's clearly that the court should review the board's action through the non-adversarial lens as opposed to imposing an exhaustion requirement. The agency-level proceedings are ex-party, non-adversarial system designed to provide the veteran with every benefit that can be supported by law.
Mr. Chisholm, if I may interrupt. Make sure that I have the facts of this case correct. This veteran was represented for 7 consecutive years by the same counsel as his contention.
Correct.
All right. So counsel had 7 years to develop his case, his theories, his issues. And when it comes to this appellate body, he changes his theory and wants us to consider it for the first time. And I'm having trouble trying to ascertain how an appellate court after all this time, for the first time, is to consider this brand new theory that was raised by the appellant in this case.
Well, I think it's also not just raised by the appellant in this case, it's also raised by the evidence below. And but to answer your question, under 7104A, the board has a statutory obligation to consider all pleadings, and under 3.103A, liberally construe those pleadings. And in the initial application for benefits, what Mr. Robinson saw and still seeks to this day is disability benefits for both the heart condition and for the thyroid condition. And it was the RO that denied it on a secondary basis.
Are those two separate claims or are those a single claim?
That's
the secondary service connection and primary service connection. Are those separate claims or are they a single claim?
Well, I think they're one claim for disability benefits. Whether
Mr. Chisholm, the briefs rely on Schroeder in the initial instance to put forth the concept that VA has an obligation to explore all theories. My question about Schroeder is there some sort of requisite amount or requisite evidence that would trigger Schroeder, or is VA obligated to sort of go down a laundry list of every applicable, or not even applicable, of every theory that could result in benefits?
My answer to that is yes. I think they have to go through each one and not just limit there to the one that looks most obvious, which in this case was the secondary condition. But once the...
But if I can pursue that, then, so if there was no evidence, say, of presumptive service connection under Agent Orange, POW, all the other theory or laws that pertain to presumptive service connection, VA would have an obligation to run through each of those, or would there need to be some sort of evidence triggering a look into a certain theory or avenue of service connection?
Well, I think they have to explore all theories, and I think that does require them to go through that laundry list. Now, if you're dealing with a veteran who was never in Vietnam, they don't have to go to Agent Orange because that person would never qualify for the Agent Orange presumption. But I do think they have to explore all theories. But
that seems to be sort of self contradict what you said. As I understood Judge Schoen's question, is does there have to be something in the evidence in the claims file to trigger the VA's requirement to analyze a particular line of reasoning to get to a service connection? And as I understood your last answer, you said if the person was never in Vietnam, they wouldn't have a responsibility to look through the Agent Orange pathway, which would seem to me to indicate that there needs to be something in the record to trigger the VA's obligation to do that.
Well, his period of service would certainly eliminate certain presumptions automatically. In this case, there is evidence in the record. There's evidence in the record of symptoms within a year of discharge, which would create the potential for the presumption under 3.309A as to the thyroid condition. And a liberal reading of that evidence,
let me kind of follow up on my initial question. I'm sorry to jump around here a little bit on you, but if we were to find that these are two separate claims as opposed to one claim for disability benefits, would that in any way affect our analysis of this case? If we find that a claim for secondary service connection is in fact itself a separate claim and a claim for service connection on a direct basis, if those two are separate claims as opposed to a single claim for disability benefits with two theories to get to that claim, would that affect our, mainly our jurisdiction, but in any way our analysis of this case?
Well, I think if you see them and view them as two separate claims, you can affirm on the secondary service connection because there really isn't anything to support that claim at this point, to be perfectly candid. And then you say, well, you can always go back and file a separate claim at the regional office and start this process anew. But the problem with that is that, in my view, it is a claim for disability benefits. I think Schroeder supports that the VA has an obligation to explore all theories. That obviously arose in a well-grounded context, but once the claim was well-grounded, they had an obligation to explore all theories of entitlement to the disability benefits. And that's what we're asking for in this particular instance.
I know we've interrupted your sort of answering our three questions. If you want to get back to that, that's fine with me. And, of course, subject to being interrupted again.
Well, if I could just jump back for a moment. I think Congress has spoken in the recent legislation that the proceedings before the agency are to remain non-adversarial, and that is notwithstanding attorney representation being allowed at the NOD stage. In Justice Connor's concurring opinion in Sim, she concluded that it would be unwise to adopt rules that impose different exhaustion obligations upon whether one is represented by counsel or not represented by counsel. The other problems that were pointed out in the NOPR brief that we adopted, and Mr. Robinson adopted, are the questions of, well, what would happen in a situation represented for a period of time down below and then is discharged to counsel? What's going to happen in that kind of situation? I think the only way to adhere to the non-adversarial nature of the VA adjudication system is to remand this case back to the board, to Mr. Robinson and the board, to decide the issue of direct service connection. If you affirm the BVA decision on the grounds of exhaustion, then you'll be denying Mr. Robinson the benefit of the non-adversarial system. Section 38 U.S.C. 511 requires the secretary to decide all questions of law and fact necessary for disposition. And 7104A, as I stated, requires the board's decision to be based on the entire record in the proceeding and upon consideration of all the evidence and material of record and applicable provisions of law.
Let me ask you this question. What specific error does the appellant find in the board decision?
I think there's two specific errors. The first one is when the board remanded the case in October of 2001, it required a medical examination on the etiology of the thyroid condition and the heart condition. I think we have the answer to the heart condition, and that is it's a result of the thyroid problem.
Okay, now are you basing your objection on Stiegel? In other words, that because the board ordered this particular exam and you believe that the exam did not comply with the board's order?
That's part of it. Stiegel is part. The other is that the exam is inadequate because it didn't answer the question of etiology as to the thyroid condition. That's the first error, if you will. It's a Stiegel/inadequate exam question.
Okay, now explain for me again the inadequacy of the exam, just without Stiegel.
Because it never, the board required it, and the answer to the question was etiology.
But that's a board requirement. That's a Stiegel error.
That's a Stiegel error.
Okay. Right. Now, how about the inadequacy portion?
Well, it's inadequate in that it didn't answer, and under Steppel, I think the requirement is to answer when possible the question of etiology of the thyroid condition, and it wasn't done in this particular instance. There was no opinion stating that the thyroid condition was coincident with service, arose within a year of discharge.
Where does that obligation come from?
Well, I think the obligation comes from the board's request.
Then that's a Stiegel error. Okay, so can we limit it to Stiegel? Is that our... I don't want to unduly limit your argument, but every time I ask you for what's the inadequacy, you go back to the board order.
It's going to be either, I can't remember whether it's 4.1 or 4.2, and I think one of the requirements is to find the cause of the etiology of the condition as well to see whether it's related to either the presumptive period or a period during service. So then I would say that would make it inadequate under those regulations.
Okay.
Mr. Chisholm, you were referring to O'Connor. Mm-hmm. How does that square with the Andrews decision of the Federal Circuit? Didn't the Federal Circuit precedentially tell us that basically it has now created two systems of reviewing claims, one for represented accounts and or claimants, and one for unrepresented? How do we fit Andrews coming down from the Federal Circuit into this equation?
I think the critical difference in Andrews is that the regulation for CUE claims requires a specific pleading requirement down below. And that's what the court based its holding on in Andrews, is the regulation under Part 20, that if there's a specific pleading requirement, then we're going to enforce that in that situation where the veteran is represented by counsel.
But isn't there also language in Andrews that says, we clarify here that the Roberson statement of sympathetic reading applies not only to Q statements, but to all pleadings filed pro se. So I don't understand how to limit Andrews to Q.
Well, I think it goes back, they also discussed the Sims case, the Andrews. And again, they were referring to, in Sims, the court relied on the regulations, the fact that there was no statute or regulation imposing the exhaustion requirement. CUE claim, there is a specific regulation. And I think the answer is that while there is a specific regulation in the CUE context where you're challenging the finality of a former decision in these other claims, there is no specific regulation that mandates issue exhaustion.
Could it sort of be a bifurcation, really, of the concept of sympathetic reading and issue exhaustion being sort of two different concepts?
Well,
that either it was implicitly in there or you just didn't argue it yet?
Right. I think the sympathetic reading is that it is implicitly in the evidence report. Absolutely. I think that is true. And it hasn't been argued yet. If I could move along to the second question. The second question was whether the court should take into consideration in its analysis of whether the board fulfilled its obligation all issues reasonably raised by the evidence when someone is represented by counsel. I think the focus here needs to be, again, on both the interest, but also on the regulation 3.103. Part A of that discusses that as an ex parte proceeding where one renders a decision which grants all benefits supported that can be supported by law. 3.103E clearly gives the veteran the right to hire whoever he wants to represent, including an attorney. And when the board fails to comply with its statutory mandate, this court shouldn't hold its action unlawful. The statute doesn't waive the obligation when counsel enters an appearance down below. What the court is focusing on is the actions of the counsel below. I think what the court should focus on is the actions of the board. It's the board's review that is under scrutiny by this court, not the counsel. As to the two questions, the first regarding EJA and whether the court should reduce an EJA award on the grounds that the veteran didn't present the issue for consideration at the agency level, I think the first answer is that it's premature at this point because until the mandate issues, obviously one can't even present an EJA application. On the merits of the issue, EJA is awarded to the prevailing party in a civil action, which is proceedings before this court. And EJA can be reduced, the amount of the award could be reduced if counsel retracts the proceedings. I think the proceedings in this instance refer to the proceedings before this court and not what happened at the agency level. It's clear that Congress, in creating 2412, knew how to factor in agency proceedings, and one looks at the agency proceedings in terms of the substantial justification issue. But I don't think it can serve to reduce award. As to the 20.609 and 5904, if a retroactive award of fees is made in this particular case, the question is whether or not they can be reduced. Again, this is premature because obviously no award has been made. But it seems to me that under 20.609, a 20% fee is presumptively reasonable. If, however, someone challenges that, either the VA or the veteran, I think that factor that the agency could look at under the terms of the regulation set forth by the VA.
I'm sorry, would you go back and what was that last statement?
Under 20.609, I think there's a number of factors. The list isn't exclusive, so I think one could, the VA or the court in examine that particular issue if the merits of the issue were before the court.
Okay, and then we would be able to look at that on appeal, if there was an appeal of that.
I think it is something you have to consider.
Let me ask you a sort of a broader question here. The VA indicates in their brief a couple concerns I'd like to hear your answer to before they argue. One is sort of a general view of the fact that an attorney who I think we have to presume has a certain level of expertise or is required to obtain that expertise in order to represent somebody who files the notice of disagreement, which has a provision to tell the VA why they appeal, who files the substantive appeal, who has the opportunity for two hearings and does not attend those hearings, has the opportunity to file a brief with the board, and never raises the issue of direct service connection, why it helps the system as far as timeliness of decision making to cause us to remand this. not, I understand that the, we're looking at the veteran here and the veteran's entitlement, but how does this help, you know, the timeliness of decision, which I know is of concern to everyone? But now, couldn't the, how is the, other than effective date, how is the appellant harmed if we choose not to consider this argument and find that we're justified, even in the face of Sims, of doing that? Are you disputing the fact that the VA adjudication system is non-adversarial?
Oh, not at all, Your Honor. Okay. I'm just purely trying to say that the role of the non-adversarial system within VA does not solely rest every burden on the agency. Non-adversarial means that if the appellant has a representative, whether an attorney or a VSO or anyone else, an agent, then non-adversarial means that everyone should be working together.
How do we not consider or ask or direct the VA to consider the direct service connection claim in light of Sims?
Basically when a claim was filed back in, I believe it was 1999, the claim was for
Are you, let me, before you begin this, let me ask, I would like to clarify your, the VA's position with regard to whether or not we're talking about a single claim or two claims.
Your Honor, the application filed in 1999 was for a single claim for compensation or for benefits. And then what the RO did was determine which theory of entitlement would get the veteran that benefit if he was so entitled.
So it's the VA's position that then that seeking direct service connection for disability benefits and secondary service connection for benefits are merely two theories to achieve disability benefits.
Correct, Your Honor. So, and in getting to Sims, so when it was adjudicated, the RO determined that the only reasonably raised theory of entitlement was by secondary service connection. And that's from a reading of the application and from all the evidence of record at that time. The Secretary doesn't feel that Sims applies. In this context, there's a lot of differences. I believe the Supreme Court even said, in remarking about the Social Security system, that to the effect that it was no more pronounced the difference between systems and Social Security when they're talking about non-adversarial systems. Social Security did not have regulations addressing the requirement to exhaust remedies. However, 7105C5 requires, and that's from Congress. Requires VA claimants.
How does it require?
They must set out specific errors, fact or law.
Excuse me. Where is the word must? The board may dismiss, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
It says allege a error, not all errors.
Well, Your Honor, they want specific error. And I think that's critical. It's more than, now, in general practice, the board does not dismiss appeals, but there's certainly.
And the board didn't dismiss an appeal here, did they?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I think the congressional intent and the regulatory structure indicates that appellants, unlike in the Social Security system, that appellants in the VA adjudication system should be alleging a specific error.
Exactly. That's what the statute says, should, correct?
Your Honor, it may.
Pardon me? I'll read it to you. The appeal should set out specific allegations of error of fact and law. At least, maybe there's another portion, but that's
correct, Your Honor.
Okay.